This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Huhib coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You can see youth on the tarmac at the airport kind of just jumping around and shouting honoraries to him, saying Baba, Oyoyo, which is like Hausa slang just to kind of celebrate the president's return.
That's reporter Chika Oduwa reporting on the return of President Buhari to Nigeria after more than 50 days in London. Details coming up.
Also, UNAID workers reach nearly 340,000 people in South Sudan, desperately in need of food and humanitarian aid. And the WHO calls for better cancer detection in Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari returned home today after spending 51 days in London. A press release describes the trip as a vacation, but adds Buhari's health had improved significantly following the medical attention he received. Rumors actually had been circulating that he was either dead or incapacitated. The Nigerian leader pledged to rededicate himself to the service of the nation. Reporter Chika Oduwa is following developments. From Abuja, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the reaction to Buhari's return.
Definitely mixed reactions. On one end, a lot of his supporters, mostly in northern Nigeria, there was a lot of jubilation, especially at the airport in Kaduna, which is where he arrived, making approximately 7 a.m. local time. You can see youth on the tarmac at the airport kind of just jumping around and shouting honoraries to him, saying Baba, Oyoyo, which is like Hausa slang just to kind of celebrate the president's return. And on another hand, there is some uncertainty and some anxiety because he still seems quite ill. So we're still not sure how long he will not be able to handle his duties because he says that he will continue to allow the vice president to remain in charge.
In a statement released by the special advisor to the president, it says that his health had improved significantly following the medical attention he received during his vacation in London. Is there any word on what he was being treated for?
There is no word at all. The government officials have been using the word vacation as opposed to medical leave. But we do know that he was supposed to be away for just 10 days, and that stretched into 51 days. And all we know is that he was in London doing some medical examinations and that his doctors requested that he remain in London to make sure that more tests were done. Last year, he was in London for an ear infection treatment. We're not sure if this is related to that or something more serious. But all we can do at this point is just to guess, you know, wonder what exactly is ailing the president.
So is the vice president handling most of the duties?
That's correct. He's handling most of the duties, including trying to turn around the economic downturn that has been plaguing the country. He's been getting a lot of commendation, actually, for being able to take charge during Buhari's absence. So he will continue to remain in that role until Buhari says that he is able to resume office.
So this raises the question of whether he would seek another term in office or whether the vice president might become his party's nomination. Is there any talk about that going on now?
There is a lot of talk as far as what's going to happen. There are a lot of political maneuvering amongst the political elites of Nigeria in the ruling party and the opposition party in case Buhari is not able to stand for re-election in 2019. Everyone is wondering, will Buhari be able to run again? There are some people trying to say that the vice president should go ahead and step in that role. And so they're now looking to see who the vice president would be in case the current vice president steps in to run as the president. So a lot of political maneuvering is happening in Nigeria.
What can you tell me about the vice president, Yemi Osinbajo?
Well, the vice president is kind of a newbie when it comes to Nigerian politics. You know, he's not a career politician. He's a trained lawyer, very educated. He's amongst the highest rank of lawyer in Nigeria, which we call a senior advocate. The highest office he's ever held was a state commissioner in Lagos. He's actually a pastor, a Christian pastor, in one of the Pentecostal churches here in Nigeria. They decided to put him, a Christian pastor, as the running mate to Buhari, who was a Muslim from the north. So that balance of regional and a religious power has to always be considered in Nigeria. So the vice president definitely fits that role. He moves around with people from different ethnic groups, from different religious backgrounds. And so some people say he's quite exposed, and they think that he's very much fit to remain as acting president.
That's reporter Chika Adua from Abuja. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The United Nations reports aid workers have succeeded in providing desperately needed food and other humanitarian aid to more than 338,000 South Sudanese facing famine in four key areas of Unity State. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN aid agencies have been scaling up relief operations in famine-stricken Unity State since February 20th, when the UN declared a localized famine in this region of South Sudan. The United Nations reports some of the 100,000 people facing starvation are dying, while another 1 million are on the brink of famine across war-torn South Sudan. Because of security concerns, the World Food Program has been airdropping food, emergency livelihood assistance, nutrition supplements, health and sanitation kits. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia tells VOA airdrops are the only option when truck convoys are unable to go by road to deliver aid.
Famines happen if aid workers don't have access. And that was the issue in those areas. Again and again over the past few years, we were able to avoid a famine in those areas. But these people now for the third time have been in really dire situation and need the outside help. It's crucially important that aid workers get access. And of course, funding is important too.
Spokesman for the Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, agrees. Unfortunately, he says a week after famine was declared in parts of South Sudan, 28 humanitarians were forced to leave Mayandit, one of the hardest-hit areas, following skirmishes north of the town.
Intensive negotiations were undertaking to try to get the aid workers back. They're critically needed in the response. However, renewed fighting has been reported on the outskirts of the town on the 1st of March, and aid organizations, the 28 aid workers, have not been able to return because of the continued fighting.
Lajerke says the UN's life-saving operation also is being hampered by a lack of funds. He says only slightly more than 9% of the $1.6 billion needed to carry out emergency operations this year has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization says about 500,000 Africans die of cancer each year, or 6% of all global deaths from the disease. But the WHO says many lives can be saved with early detection and treatment. From Washington, reporter William Eagle has the story.
The WHO says the leading cancers in Africa affect the breast, cervix, and prostate. Lung cancer, a prominent cause of death in the industrialized world, accounts for only 5% of cases in Africa. Dr. Andre Ilbawi is the technical officer for cancer control at WHO headquarters in Geneva. He says the cause of the illness in Africa is not always clear, though factors that may contribute to breast cancer include alcohol use, obesity, and lack of physical activity. Weakened immune systems also play a role. They are susceptible to many diseases, including cervical cancer, which is often caused by the human papillomavirus, or HPV.
The women in Africa have a higher rate of HIV, and HIV exacerbates or makes worse the effect of HPV, human papillomavirus. So we see the combination of those infectious causes really can explain the majority of cervical cancer cases in Africa and elsewhere.
Ilbawi says besides HPV, other infections can also lead to cancer.
We know that the immune system has a very important role in fighting cancer, and also in some situations, infections can directly cause cancer themselves. So having a strong immune system, we know, contributes to keeping a cancer risk low. It's not always as easy as saying malaria, for example, triggers cancer years down the line for someone who had an exposure to malaria. But we do know that there are very much some cause and effects for infectious causes of cancer on the continent of Africa. Some include, as I mentioned, that human papillomavirus that contributes to cervical cancer. Hepatitis B and C contribute to liver cancer. There are infections in the stomach that can contribute to gastric cancer. So infections, both directly and by weakening the immune system, can contribute to cancer cases.
Not all cancers are fatal, especially if they are detected early. The WHO is working to encourage governments to adopt measures that are low cost but high impact, especially on the local or primary care level.
Early diagnosis has a strategic position in health expenditures because if we are able to detect cancer early, then the costs of treatment are lower. We know from high-income countries, for example, that detecting cancer at a stage one or stage two reduces the cost of treatment in a significant way, between 2 to 4-fold in some settings.
He also says earlier detection makes it likely that less toxic medications can be used. WHO guidelines suggest inexpensive ways to improve cancer detection, beginning by educating the public and health workers on how to recognize potential symptoms.
But we need that person, that provider, to identify high-risk symptoms and say to a patient, I understand that you're having bleeding in your stool or a new mass or a new lump. That's concerning to you, and it's also concerning to me. This may be cancer. This may not be cancer. This could be many other possible diseases. But what you need to do from here is get to the secondary level, get to the diagnostic facility so you can have access to biopsy and pathology to confirm whether or not it's cancer. Yeah. And that first-level provider is critical because that's where most patients go first. And we have to bring those providers into the health system for cancer, not just focus on developing high-cost treatment at a centralized facility when most people are either unable to get to that facility, can't afford those treatments, or get there far too late.
Other low-cost options include providing social workers and patient navigators who can help direct patients to facilities that provide blood and tissue testing and treatment. Ildawi says therapies for cancer patients do not have to be costly. They might include surgery, chemotherapy, and oral or hormonal treatments. The WHO advises countries on how to improve cancer care, including providing insurance and other mechanisms that make treatment packages affordable. Ildawi says it's a coordinated effort that includes governments, advocacy groups, the UN, and donors. Together, they help identify where strategic investments can help improve health services and extend the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. After spending more than 50 days in London, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari returned home today. Aid workers have succeeded in providing desperately needed food to thousands of South Sudanese facing famine. And the WHO calls for better cancer detection in Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
In Malawi, the first survey of national crop estimates has projected that the country will largely have a bumper harvest of food crops this year. Commentators say this is good news for the country, where nearly half of the population is facing food shortage due to floods and drought in the past 2 years. But as Lamech Messina reports from Blantyre, the recent invasion of fall armyworms will likely affect the harvest.
The Minister of Agriculture Services farmers will this year harvest 3.2 million metric tons of maize, the country's main food crop. This represents an increase of 35.9% over last year's amount, which was 2.3 million tons. The survey also indicates that the rice harvest will increase by 41.5% over last year. Sweet potatoes are expected to increase by 27%, while millet and sorghum production will increase by an average of 90%. However, major cash crop tobacco is expected to decrease by 37%. Felix Jumbe is the chairperson for Alliance for Commodity Trade in East and Southern Africa. He told VOA that the maize crop this year could have been greater if not for the invasion of four armyworms.
This time they are turning into butterflies, so I think they have completed their cycle. But the impact is heavy. That will take away some of the yields that we could have got better this year.
Jumbe, who is also a commercial farmer, says his efforts to control the worms proved futile.
I was applying cyclomethrin three times in the field. There was no impact until I changed to another one I bought from Managodi. I have even forgotten the name. I've seen some minimal change, but the impact is really heavy.
George Georgian is an entomologist at the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture, involved in research effort to find an effective pesticide to control the caterpillars. He told CNN recently that the existing chemicals being used in Africa to kill the four armyworms are not likely to succeed. He said in the US, genetically modified crops have been used to combat them, although they have developed defenses. The Food and Agriculture Organization has warned that the species of the armyworms that have attacked crops in southern Africa this year are hard to kill, saying they were bone survivors. Chimimba David Piri is FAO sub-regional coordinator for southern Africa.
Should it not be controlled in time, it can be very devastating for all types of cereals, particularly maize. And then there is also a possibility of it spreading across the sub-region. But we hope it will not come to that.
Over 100,000 hectares of farmland have been infested in Zambia. Zimbabwe is reporting the worms in 7 of the country's 8 corn-growing provinces. And in Malawi, the outbreak, which started in 8 districts, is now widespread. But a local daily reported last week that some farmers in Chikwawa and Mangochi district in southern Malawi are using traditional and physical ways of dealing with the drug-resistant armyworms. It said some of them are applying leaves of a neem tree on the attacked crops, while others are physically killing the caterpillars. Jumbe says the method would only work for small-scale farmers.
This is somebody maybe with 1 acre or half acre. But a person like me who is having 100 hectares of maize a field, that methodology would not be effective to treat them.
Erika Maganga is the principal secretary in the Ministry of Agriculture. She said she hopes the insects will soon disappear.
Normally occur when you have a season where you have rains and then you have sunshine. Rain, sunshine, eh? It creates conducive environment for the outbreak of the armyworms. When you have continuous rains, they go. So with the rains that are coming, that have started from last week to now, and if they continue, they don't survive.
Maganga advises farmers to consult agriculture extension workers whenever they see the pests in their fields. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
The Kenyan government is firing doctors who went on strike 3 months ago and left the healthcare sector in crisis. As Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, the two sides are trying to work out the terms of a collective bargaining agreement covering salaries and other matters.
Kenyans remain in limbo after the government and doctors failed to agree on and sign documents that cover a range of issues including better pay and working conditions for the doctors, improved health facilities and security for medical staff. Peter Munya is the governor of the state of Meru and chairman of the Council of Governors. He says the government remains firm in its decision to penalize doctors who refuse to return to work.
The decision we took still stands, and I'm told there are processes. People are now following processes of laying off those who have not reported back to work. I'm told like Embu now already notices have been given. So that is what we are implementing.
On Wednesday, the biggest hospital in the country, Kenyatta National Hospital, fired 12 medics and put 48 others on notice. Kenyan media report a handful of physicians returned to work. Dr. George Goat is with the union that represents the doctors. He says it is National Advisory Council agreed to propose amendments presented in a collective bargaining agreement that now awaits the signature of both parties.
I can only confirm that we were told that the CBA will be signed with amendments. I'll not tell you exactly which amendment because that is fairly confidential. So the third document to be signed is a formal return to work formula setting out the procedures of returning to work.
Dr. Ogot says the union has yet to receive word whether the government will sign the documents, but that union officials remain optimistic. The government had taken the step of arresting union officials in an effort to end the strike, even as the doctors refused to back down.
National Advisory Council remain committed, and so far we've not received any communication that those documents will not be signed. We are just waiting for our negotiators to brief us. As and when they sign and they advise us to resume work, we already gave them our blessing and we shall resume work.
Governor Munya confirmed to VOA that changes were made to the previous collective bargaining agreement of 2013, in which doctors sought a pay raise of up to 180%. The government's offer stands at 40%. Munya says the government is considering hiring foreign doctors.
We want to start now working out the process of hiring doctors from outside the country. And the Minister for Health is already working on that. He's already exploring diplomatic channels, talking to friendly countries that can provide doctors. And then he's also working on the legal framework to register these doctors locally.
This is not the first time the government has announced a plan to fire doctors and bring in physicians from abroad. The state plans to hire physicians from neighbouring Tanzania, as well as Cuba and India. Before that happens, an appeals court will have to rule on the matter. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
UTC.